that's more centered.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Great.
If you guys want to see, like, really cool things, okay.
Hello. All right, great. This is excellent. So, hello, and welcome to a live recording of the Paper Cuts podcast. Paper Cuts is an exploration of the contemporary world of book arts, zines, and small press publishing. I am your host, Christopher Cardenbecus. We are here at the Carnegie Museum of Art for the first Pittsburgh Art Book Fair. Before we get started, I want to thank the team of the Pittsburgh Art Book Fair for all their hard work organizing this awesome event. Mary, Caroline, Chaz, Emma, and Jacqueline. And I'd like to thank the Carnegie Museum for hosting this event, and especially Dana and Blaine for their work making this podcast recording happen. I actually used to live in Pittsburgh, and this city is where I produced my very first zines, so I'm very excited and grateful to be part of the Pittsburgh Art Book Fair. For those of you in the audience, I would really introduce our panel. Paper Cuts as a podcast is real casual, so we're hanging out here on the floor of the theater. I have a set of specific questions for each of our guests, but my hope is that these questions serve as a departure point for larger group conversations. We will be talking up here for about 45 or so minutes, and then we'll open this up for questions from our audience. And to introduce our panel, I'm very happy to be talking with Aaron Millay and Paper Buck of Tree News, Bekazela Mguni of the Black Unicorn Library and Archive Project, and Adriana Monsalve of Homey House Press. And to fully introduce everyone with their bios, so we all know who we're talking to, Aaron Millay is a multidisciplinary artist exploring the past and present of particular microcosms as entry points into larger environmental, social, and political conditions. Often public and collaborative in nature, her work manifests in a range of media, including installation, film, photography, and writing. She has exhibited at galleries, museums, and DIY art spaces, including LeBand Art Gallery in Los Angeles, Air Gallery in Brooklyn, and the Miller ICA in Pittsburgh. She sent vibrations from a giant fungus throughout the atmosphere and currently publishes Tree News, a newsletter about trees, people, and places. Aaron holds an MFA from Carnegie Mellon University and is an assistant professor of arts at the Pennsylvania State University School of Visual Arts. Paper Buck is an interdisciplinary visual artist, printmaker, and writer. His recent work is focused on place-centered research that critically explores white settler constructions of conservation, ecology, and the American landscape. Paper received his MFA from Carnegie Mellon University in 2020 and earned a bachelor's degree in studio arts from McAllister College in 2008. His practice is informed by a background in community organizing that centers anti-racist education, decolonial movements, and transgender justice. He was formerly a leadership team member at the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project, Unsettling Minnesota, and the Catalyst Project. Paper was the former printmaking studio manager at Kala Art Institute, and he publishes a collaborative artist newsletter, Tree News, with Aaron Millay. Bekazela Mguni is a queer Trinidadian artist, radical librarian, and educator. She has over 15 years of community organizing experience in the reproductive justice movements and holds an MLIS from the University of Pittsburgh. Bekazela participated in the first Librarians and Archivists with Palestine delegation in June of 2013. She completed her first micro residency at Pittsburgh Creative Hub, Boom Concepts, and was featured in the 2015 Open Engagement Conference. She was a 2015-2016 member of the Penn Avenue Creative Accelerator Program with the Kelly Strayhorn Theater and launched the Black Unicorn Library and Archive Project. The Black Unicorn cultivates libraries as sites of learning, possibility, and freedom, celebrating the literary and artistic contributions of Black women, queer, trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming people. Honoring the far-reaching influences their stories has on the lives of generations worldwide. She has also served as the 2016 Sophia Smith Archive Artist in Residence at Smith College. She was featured artist of the 2017 Activist Print Project, a partnership between Artist Image Resources, Boom Concepts, and the Andy Warhol Museum. Bekazela is a Boom Concept Studio member, a community space and gallery dedicated to the development of artists and creative entrepreneurs. She is currently the artistic director of Dreams of Hope, which affirms the voices and leadership of LGBTQ youth through the arts. Last but not least, Adriana Monsalve is an artist, cultural worker, and collaborative publisher working in the photo book medium. Along with Katarina Rag, Monsalve is co-founder of Pomi House Press, a radical cooperative platform that challenges the ever-changing forms of storytelling with image and text. The works of Pomi House Press have been collected in the Library of Congress, Thomas J. Watson Library at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and the Maryland Institute College of Art, among other private collections. Within her photographic practice, Monsalve is an archivist and visual communicator who produces in-depth stories on identity through the nuances in between race, gender, and immigrant-adjacent experiences. Within her cultural work as a collaborative publisher, she holds space for and with underrepresented communities through the multidisciplinary platform of Pomi House Press, a cooperative playground where photos become books, a safe space for secret stories, and an open house for honest content that meets at the intersection of personal, political, and poetic. She is rigorously pushing towards finding ways for photographers and publishers to cultivate the capacity for care and tenderness within structures that actively work against their manifestations. She defines intimacy as the experience of being genuinely seen, heard, held by another person or group of people. Again, thank you all so much for being on this panel with me. I'm very excited for this. I've only really spoken to Adriana before, so this is my first time meeting the majority of you, and I'm very happy to be learning more about your practices. And Adriana, I'm gonna be coming to you first.
Okay.
I've always loved the part of your statement that refers to this being a personal, political, and poetic practice. And also from your statement, I'm curious about your work as an archivist, and I'd like you to tease this out a bit for us. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on how publishing functions as an archiving project process and project. The idea of the archive and the idea of publishing seems to operate in different directions, collecting and consolidating versus dispersing. And I think a strength of your work and the work of Pomi House Press is how you navigate the space in between those opposing poles.
So a lot of the work that we do with Pomi House is working with immigrant-adjacent communities and immigrant communities. Immigrant-adjacent just means like me. Like, I was an immigrant, my parents were. A lot of times we've lost our histories. We don't have access to those histories. This isn't just like something that comes from like Latinx identity. This is from Black identities too, when we're talking about enslaved cultures and all these things. Like, there's levels to losing our stories, losing our history, knowing where we come from, and having access to understanding fully the whole capacities of our stories. I think the archive is something that, because there's so much that I personally didn't know about myself, and also just when we're talking about like Latinidad and Latinx identities in general, like, there's so much that we don't know, even outside of like where we come from, in the sense that the enslaved, the indigenous, and the colonizer all live in this body and have to make peace every day in this body. So like, there's just so much that I had to like really push against to really understand what is even Latinx, when it's not, right, it's not a race, it's an amalgamation of identities. And these are all confusing things for a younger Adriana to confront with and to really like come to terms with. Stories and like archiving, I think in that sense has always been like, just I've naturally gravitated towards, because I'm curious and I don't know and I want to know. And she has a lot of questions and like very little answers, which is really like, that's really where we should be, always having more and more questions. I think from that space, it naturally, Pomi House naturally, like, I think attracted people and collaborators that are kind of working from that same space where like, we just did this really beautiful project with two students that their uncle migrated on the Martil boat lift from Cuba in the 1980s. And as a queer trans person, like, they feel like my uncle would have never like been able to, like, when we're talking about like refugees from Cuba, like queer folks never get that spotlight. And so they're like, we really want to do this project where we can highlight the story and we can like archive it and talk about like, what was it even like for my uncle 40 years ago now to like, to have come and with his homies and like, what did that look like? And yeah, so there's so many different stories that like, that are connecting to this that are all stemming from really wanting to know like our family stories and in so many different ways. And it's just really, it's really crazy to see it grow in so many ways like that. Did I answer
one
part of the question, I think? She's
yeah.
Talkative, yeah.
Okay.
She's
chatty. No, I really appreciate that. I think that actually does do a bit of first question, so thank you. And I think we're going to be coming back around this
okay,
idea
cool,
a couple times throughout the talk.
You got it.
Thanks, Zayla. The library and archive was recently housed at Boom Studios in Pittsburgh and is currently looking for a new base, but you regularly collaborate with institutions to develop programming. Can you trace the evolution of the archive project for us? I can only imagine that in the work of creating new worlds and new ways to be in the world, that each collaboration offers a different way to celebrate Black queer histories.
Thank you. thank you for asking that question. And I think I really appreciated what you were sharing about like sort of excavating and digging for answers to those questions. And brought me to this moment of getting a chapbook of Stacey Enshin's poetry when I was 17, when I first came to Pittsburgh. And I never gave that chapbook back, I'm sorry. But the reason that's important, and I use that as like a focal point, is when I came to Pittsburgh, you know, I had recently, my exit plan was come out and have, and you could leave, you know? So I had left home and I had a place, I had a destination. So no matter what the reception was, I had a place to go. You know, luckily, you know, with some time, received with a lot of love, but it was something that growing up as a Trinidadian, I did not see a lot of queer culture represented. And what I did see was often really represented in music, and was really violent and abusive, unfortunately, right? And so when I came to Pittsburgh, I had this sort of new space. And someone I met who was a young queer Latina, actually, let me borrow her book, we're still friends. And I've never read the words of a queer West Indian person. You know, I've never read the words of a person who said, I'm Korean, I'm from Trinidad, I'm from Jamaica. I never saw someone like that. And to read her words and then to see her perform, it was just amazing. And to say, wow, I'm not alone, I'm not the first, you know? Mm-hmm. And for me, thinking about the evolution of the Black Unicorn Library Project is really about having moments in my life where, you know, Black women and Black LGBTQ people's writing find me, it finds me along the way, and I'm held, I'm seen, I'm not alone, I'm present with myself again. And in a lot of ways that has saved my life. And so the project, the work, is really about cultivating, you know, a real celebration of what that writing does, of what that courageous storytelling does, because it's across space and time that Audre Lorde's work has found me, and found me as a young person. Because after reading Stacey Enshin's book, I found someone gave me Zami, you know? And if I hadn't read Zami, I also wouldn't have seen like, oh, wow, I have a legacy of queer Caribbean people that I come from. And, you know, it's really about learning to read histories different, reading to learn, you know, really learning how to see between what's been omitted to see ourselves. And so I really think about this project as an ongoing celebration of Blackness, of Black queer expression, of
Black women and girls and femmes and Black gender expansive people really defying this idea that they don't have the right to express themselves. And in the act of doing that, not only saving themselves and naming their experience how they want to, but because they do that, they leave evidence, they leave information for us coming up. And so the work is really about making sure that people understand, because when I, especially thinking about young people being like, oh, you know, when you come into the world, they want you to feel alone and isolated and as though you have no legacy and no history. But a big part of the medicine that we need is to be recognize that we have ancestry. We have a long legacy. We've always been here. And the type of erasure, the violent erasure that we're facing on an everyday basis is precisely because we're powerful and present. And so, you know, I would say it's, you know, folks finding me, spirit finding me. And yeah, Audre Lorde was and is and remains a huge beacon of inspiration, and you know, really being able to read her words and learn about her life and meet people who lived with her, knew her, you know, were connected to her in different ways, and realizing, wow, how did I end up in Pittsburgh? Because I'm from Trinidad, you know, how did I end up here and find this queer Caribbean woman who I never met, but she wrote across space and time so that I could know not only do I have a reason, I have a purpose, and I have a responsibility, right? To myself, to my community, and that we all have it, you know? And so it's definitely ancestors that I'm in partnership with. And then in terms of institutions and organizations, it's so many collaborators. This project has been full of collaborators, some of which you've mentioned. Boom Concepts has been a collaborator for many years in many different ways. And, you know, I've popped up in that space repeatedly, first as a Pittsburgh POC zine distro, then evolving into the library. And yeah, you know, I think the work, and I know I'm kind of, because I can't name them all. we've been in farmers markets, we've been at colleges, we've been at conferences, we've been in gardens, we've been on, you know, in every kind of space that you can imagine. And it's really about celebrating a love of reading, celebrating what reading and literacy can do for liberating the self, also expanding what we think literacy is, and what we think intelligence is, right? And realizing that, you know, one of the reasons why we started this project is to let people, you know, Nikki Finney talks about this in her 2011 National Book Award speech, which is an amazing expression. And she reminds us that we are the only group of people forbidden to become literate in this country, but forbidden to become literate in this particular format. We came with so much intelligence and so much knowledge, right? And so really it's about realizing that Black people are queer, Blackness is queer, and Blackness, and this is a cultural intervention in a white supremacist structure, right? To say, we have always been who we are, right? There's no, it's important, it's just about remembering. It's about, white supremacy is about disconnection from land, from ancestry, from spirit, from all beings. And it's really about us remembering how to be in connection. And I really appreciate what you shared in your bio about intimacy. And I think that is really a good, that's a key piece that I'm still meditating on, because it's also about community building. And I think libraries do specific kinds of work in communities that hold space for us to build in relationship with each other and help us believe things about each other that we can actually practice together, that we don't always get to practice when we, use other systems of ownership and hoarding. And we can say, oh, wow, we have shared wealth and resources, and we can believe that we want to share with each other and believe the best about each other in certain ways. So it's a lot of things. And really, I can just say Blackness is Queer is really about elevating that, celebrating life, remembering when I forget, you know. And we've had a lot of beautiful evolutions and partnerships. And I'll say, because we're in this space right now, the best thing is, I don't even know if it's the best thing, but one of the best parts of this work has been, like I said, connecting with people who have been in relationship with all of these ancestors and elders. And I will lift up Ada Gay Griffin, who is a dear elder of mine, who I've known for some time. And she is one of the filmmakers of A Litany for Survival, which is about Audre Lorde's life, you know. And to the way spirit moves, that's really what this project is. And like, to be in relationship with the elders, with community, who are committed to just queer liberation. That's, you know, when I am an immigrant, when I don't have community who become my family, that's how I know this project is rooted in a Black queer liberation, you know, grounding. So that's all over the place, but that's what I'm sharing with
you. Thank you so much. That was really beautiful and like a wonderful way to start talking about histories and legacies. And there's something like both of your answers about embodied histories. I think that we can put in that and start talking about it as we open up conversation between everyone. So thank you. Tree News. I'm curious about the Tree News as an archiving practice I'm curious about the Tree News as archiving practices that both are and are not local by the nature of documenting several different artists' practices. Centering trees and plants dilates the focus, pushing against the immediacy of the climate crisis and human cause, as well as calling back to local histories that develop with and around non-human bodies. Can you tell us how exploring this web of practices helps to articulate a variety of conceptual and physical landscapes?
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for having us, and it's wonderful to be here with everybody. We, Paper and I, collaborate on this project, so we'll kind of pass the mic back and forth a little bit. But I guess I can start a little bit by introducing Tree News as a newsletter and event series. And we focus on kind of tree and forest stories as entry points into larger conversations around climate change adaptation, and artist practices that relate to the environment. And just to give, I think, personally some background in terms of my interest in like cultural relationships to land and environment. I grew up in Idaho, rather like rural state, a lot of kind of quote wilderness area. And I have sort of grandparents that lived in a former mining town that then became sort of a ghost town and worked as sheep herders, and just became interested in kind of this family history of like a deep relationship to land as place of livelihood, but also this history of extraction, especially in the American West and colonial legacy there. And I think I became more aware about these kind of dynamics in relationship to land. And when I came to Pittsburgh, that feels very apparent here as well in terms of sort of coal industry and the very sort of visible transformation of the landscape and the disproportionate impacts. And so all that to say is that when I met Paper, we had a lot of similar kind of interests in looking at kind of the past, the sort of reverberations of the past and the present in relationship to land and in relationship to kind of ideas about like cultural ideas of land as resource. And so for Tree News, you know, goal is to look at kind of different local stories and kind of what people are doing locally in terms of relationship to land here, and looking at artists whose work engages with that topic too. I want to let paper jump in here too, as far as.
Can you finish?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that I also, you know, we profile people and places. I grew up in a very small town that's densely forested. I often find myself wanting to be in the woods. And when I am there, I tend to sort of think about and look at the forest as an archive, physically itself. And this kind of grew out of, there's a particular forest behind my mother's home that I had just spent my whole life being in. And I started realizing that this particular forest had, the ways that people thought about it were very wrapped up in settler mythologies and this idea of an American landscape, which I don't think exists. But this particular forest was socially constructed across the 19th and 20th century as the largest old growth forest in southern New England. And people, the Appalachian Trail went through it. People would, you know, take, there was tourism focused on going to this forest. And then a tornado came through and knocked down most of the forest. And they realized that, in fact, it was not an old growth forest. It had regrown from a colonial clear cut. And to me, that was just a powerful remaking of the sort of settler myth of the place. And so as I kind of dove into this place, you know, of course, I can only I can only tell so much of the story myself. So I started reaching out to Indigenous organizers in the region, ecologists in the region, biologists who had studied the site after the tornado, writers, historians, and I started working with archives in the Historical Society in our town and building this image base of the history of clear cutting in the town, which it's now densely forested, but it had this long history of being routinely clear cut prior. So just through the process of researching that, I found that it's just a really interesting way to relate to place, to seek out many different perspectives from people who have significant relationships to a given place. So I think in some ways, some of that approach to sort of place-based research has influenced our work. Just that you really cannot know a place through a singular perspective. And, you know, by kind of using place as a way to let different relationships to culture, politics, identity converge, can be a really expansive conversation that maybe creates, fosters connection across different people who are in relationship through place. So,
can I add something?
Yeah.
One thing too that I wanted to add that I appreciate you were talking about knowledge and different forms of knowledge and kind of, and like, I think one thing about tree news too, when you're talking about sort of different people's relationships to a place and having a wider understanding of a place and what makes it up and how different ideas of basically about land sort of recreate particular maybe structures or hierarchies or things like that. And I think one thing in relationship to tree news that we're interested in doing is having different people with kind of different understandings of that place, like people was just speaking to, sort of share their knowledge and share their relationship to it. So, you know, we've interviewed like, you know, sort of botanists, artists. I did a residency in Utah and I worked with a lot of youth that were high school students, and we did these workshops together, and it was really like them sharing kind of like their very specific relationship kind of to this place and their understanding of this place and their personal histories in this place. And I think kind of tree news as a space to bring these different perspectives and different orientations to a place and knowledge of it. I wanted to kind of speak to some of those specific things that we've done that I think the goal is sort of is what the paper is talking about. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
This is so great, guys. I love this already. And from here, we're going to start to open it up. I'll preface this next question by saying that the espresso that Dana gave me has now hit. I'm over here typing rapidly. So it doesn't make any sense outside America. But I think about one thing that is a through line running through all your practices. This can maybe be described as the very porous community-based practices that are all rooted in narrative that ultimately work against a single author of history or single way of knowing that makes room for a variety of embodied histories, a variety of queer embodied histories. And I'd like to kind of pick apart this idea of world building and intentional world building that you're all engaged in, because it does find strength in specific stories around place that can, I want to say, like, build a better future based on elements of that future that are already embedded in the present. Does anyone feel like running with that? And I think something that got me moving on this is specifically thinking, Adriana, about you talking about your history as an embodied history, where the colonizer and the colonized live in the same body and has to, like, work with us. And I'm thinking also, Xayla, about, like, embodied histories in book form, or the book as an embodied history. And I think that we can also think about embodied histories in landscapes.
Oh, okay. Were you interested?
You can start, Hungry.
Okay. Yeah, share from what I know or what I feel. I think, you know, it's interesting because at the top of last year, can you hear me? At the top of last year, elders were sharing this idea of embodied stewardship. And I was taking that very listening really closely in that moment as like a note for like what archival practice can be as well. And I appreciate what you said about the forest being an archive, because that's part of the work too, right? To really explore what we think archives are. Mm-hmm. Because we've been taught that it must be a person of a certain status, of a certain way, mm-hmm. to be remembered. And it's really not the case, right? That's just who happens to have a certain form of power and a certain kind of authorship. And it's really when we have the opportunity to be practitioners in our communities and to embody our forms of stewardship, we get to say, oh, you may have said my ancestors or elders were illiterate, but they could read the stars, they could read the forest, they could read the tide, they could read so many things. And you depended on that intelligence for your survival. So you don't get to dismiss that or denigrate it, right? And we get to do this work of appreciating, reclaiming, relearning, remembering, and then sharing and stewarding it. And part of that stewardship is, can I learn a song? Can I learn a dance? Can I learn a phrase or a proverb? Can I practice a way of being as well? And, you know, last year I would say, out of the book, into the body, you know, because the book is great, but it is just a vessel. You know, each of us are, you know, when we say, you know, when an elder dies, a library burns down, it's because it's us, you know, that hold, I am your archive. You all are my archive. How I am remembered in community is my archive. You know, that is important for us to know and tell and speak about, you know, for us to elevate our value and capability and power in that. Because if we don't do it, they say this book is the one that has the proper remembrance of who you are. And they're like, well, she never, she don't like orange, like that. She likes special things. Yeah. You know, and if 10 people who knew me can say that, that's the archive, right? That we can rely on. Because the archive is made up of us. It's flawed. It's flawed. It's a site of violence in some ways. And it can be a site of violence. It can be a beautiful space of discovery, but it can also be a real space of violence. So my
perspective in approaching my work is thinking about the multiple ways that the construction of what our archive is this like also this human inclination to tell story, to remember. Like we do this thing of archiving in different ways. You know, we have our reel, we have our storyteller, we have our memory keeper. And then with this, you know, maybe I guess the introduction of thinking that the written word is the end all, be all, which is like, you know, contentious type of vibe in the bigger scheme of all the ways that we practice remembering, because I'm thinking about the whales. I'm like, what's the whales archive? And the Atlantic is surely an archive.
Yeah.
You know, and I lift up Alexis Pauline Gumbs and her work in an archive and clearly, you know, elevating and laying that out too for us too, right? But like, it's back to our relationship to nature, because we think it's us at the top and everybody and everything else. And it's like, ego versus ego is us together. We are with these other relatives on the planet, you know, and I don't want to be too long-winded, but I think, you know, it is us having the capacity to hold the multitude of, you know, this human possibility. Like we have created all these amazing languages, and we've, you know, we have language, we have written, we have technology of writing, which is so powerful. And then we also have, you know, the natural clock, which is like the goldenrod is here. That's a signal of a change of time, you know what I mean? And to be able to read that is as important as something else, you know? And so I feel that it's so important, because we've constructed these systems of erasure and violence and of oppression, that we have to do work as librarians and archivists and culture keepers and memory workers to help people remember what is necessary for healing and wholeness, right? That you belong, you are a part of, you know, the system that's telling you you're not is lying to you. And, you know, when you think about, you were talking about the forest. And I was just telling somebody I went to Cook Forest. It's 2 hours away from here. It's like 8,500 acres, but like 2/3 of it were cut down before they decided to preserve it and have this legacy, you know? And it's just like all this extraction before you get to the land that you leave for us. And it's like, no, we really have to question the stories and how what the stories that were told and how they're told to us, because they'll have us regarding these people as so well-intentioned and so well-meaning, nice. But oh no, you exploited and extracted and decimated this forest before you decided to save the last bit of it. Let's put the story in the right process. And I'm grateful that it's still here, but I want you to tell the whole truth. And I'll just wrap up by saying that I think that it's just important for us to be in our communities and our families, recognizing that all of these roles are not for for one type of person. Like, you don't have to be educated in a specific context in order to do this work. To be a memory keeper in your family or in your community, to hold the stories, you know, it's about just recognizing that our lives are important and valuable, and someone is going to need to know how you define intimacy one day so that they can become closer to themselves and to other people. And you wrote that. Or as someone maybe taught you that, and maybe you had a lived experience that you were like, wow, I need to expand my vulnerability, you know, and you learn, and then someone, because that's what humans do, they need somebody to tell them, and they go find it, and they're like, oh, So you write and you talk about yourself, you remember something, you remember what this person said, because it's not always for you, it is for others too. So, you know, we are in that, we have to do that work because of those structures that we find ourselves in that have been built and that we're fighting against, you know, and, you know, we have to, even if we don't see the huge transformation in our lifetime, know that the adding on, you know, and I'll just close one thing by saying is the reason why the whales were on my mind was because there was this conversation with Alexis Pauline Gums, Adrienne Marie Brown, and another sister, I'm forgetting her name, and but she, I want to look her up, she goes and listens to the whales. She goes to Brazil and listens to the whales. And she sings to them too. And she's like bringing back what they're feeling right now.
I know exactly who she is.
It's like, that's the kind of work we need to go and think about. What are the trees witnessing? You know, and I was thinking, the trees don't hide. We're the ones that are closed.
Yeah.
They're just out there. I was in the forest. I was like, let's put our belly on the tree. And I had to lift my clothes up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What's that? Yes, Michaela. I didn't want, yeah, Michaela Harrison.
Yep.
Please look her up and look up her work, because the reason it's important is because they're telling us something and they have been here for a long, long time. Right? And we need to listen. And as human beings, we need to be in relationship. And I think all of this work helps us remember how to help us get back into right relationship with all, you know, so.
Thank you so much. That's really beautiful. So tree news, what are the trees saying?
Yeah, I mean, I love where you just ended, because in a lot of ways, I think the tree news is actually, for me, motivated by a desire to learn to be in relationship. And, you know, there's so, you know, for me, and I think the, you know, the idea of humans over here and nature over there, I mean, obviously ridiculous, but how do we really build reciprocity, you know, like how do we actually center our lives around those relationships? How do we learn from, you know, multiple communities? How do we, you know, bring land care, land tending into our lives? And so for me, Tree News is an opportunity to have a reason to reach out to people who I want to learn from and talk to them. And, you know, one project that our second issue was focused on was Southside Park in Pittsburgh, which is one of Pittsburgh's less known city parks. And it was given to the city in 1930 as just a completely, like, total, there was not one single piece of vegetation on that hillside. Former mine, former coal mine, former industrial site. And unlike Schenley or Frick, there was no landscaping or forestry or planting that happened. So over the course of 100 years, you know, it grew back naturally. A lot of that land got taken over by non-native species that, you know, are not participating in the broader ecology of the region in the same way that, you know, more native plants would. So basically during COVID, Aaron and I started going every week to Southside Park and joining with this community called Friends of Southside Park. It was people who lived around the sort of perimeter of the park who were working to rebuild biodiversity at the park. And it was like an around the seasons effort. Like there was, you know, for coming in with the goats in the fall, coming in with, you know, pickaxes, pulling out certain roots in the winter, coming in and planting in the spring. And so it was, you know, it's a process that's been going on for about a decade, and there's probably hundreds of people who have been involved in restoring this particular forest. So in a way, I guess I think of you know, part of what I find compelling about participating and producing this newsletter is that it allows me to actually do the things that I want to do and learn, and directly gives me the opportunity to learn from folks that I don't know, skills that, you know, I don't have, maybe don't come from, you know, my, I guess I feel like my cultural history around forestry is not one I want to reproduce. So I love having the opportunity to reach out to other folks and learn, you know, different practices that really produce an actuality of connection, you know, both for me with plants and flora and fauna, and also, you know, very importantly with other people.
When I think about world building and the ways that we are trying to do that within Homey House, I think a lot about how, well, I mean, you guys heard from what Christopher said, but yeah, Homey House is specifically challenging the way that photojournalism is used and really looking at the harms that have been caused with photography specifically and trying to do less harm. We can never make a safe space because that's not fully, I can only control myself. So I can't ever promise a safe space, but I can try to do less harm. When I think about that, the longer, right, so I've been doing Homey House for 6 years now, and the longer that I work with photography and the more I spend time in photography, the more I'm like, I don't know why photography is taught in this way that it's a document, that the photo is a document, when it's like, when we already know that like the white gaze is what has made photojournalism so dangerous and so harmful. And we know that that's just like you're saying, it's just one opinion and it's just one way of looking at it. And it's just one, like, that's not a true story. And so like photography should never be seen as a document. And that's like, and it's like, I don't know why that happened. Like, it's like photography was pushed into that space so long ago, and it's like, I don't, and the more now, like with AI photography that I'm like fascinated with, I'm just like, this is challenging all of that more, which I love, and it's making that space so much more messy, and I'm hoping that there's going to be a day when we stop teaching that photography is a document, and that photography is like the quickest and easiest way to archive, and the most like accessible way to make a document of something. Because it's just an opinion, it's just one way of doing it, and it's really just your perspective. It's just like any other art form. And the longer photography, the more, I realize how much photography is flawed, the more, and that's where Homey House started from. And so it is a space where we're actively really trying to like, look at it through a personal lens first and later connect that to the political. But I think like, that's kind of like, I don't know, that's kind of like the hard and the big thing with, I feel like when we're talking about abolition, and we're talking about that, it's like, abolition means that you start, it's the personal first. It's like it's the everyday connections, it's the everyday interactions before you like make these big changes and you get into political spaces. And that's why I think like Homey House, we're so focused on like excavating from our own bodies and really trying to understand what is all these stories that are in here. I've been using a camera for half of my life at this point, and I'm still excavating so much from here. And I don't think I'll ever finish. That's what I have to say about that.
Well, thank you. And here's to never finishing the work. I'm just looking at the time. I think we should start to open this up to audience questions. Does anyone in our audience have a question? I'll bring the microphone to you.
Hi, so this was a really cool discussion to listen to. And I was curious. It seems like just publishing or archiving can seem very closed off to a lot of people. Like if you're not in academia, I'm not sure like all of your backgrounds. So I was wondering if you felt at all, if it was hard to get started on whether it was archiving or just publishing, if you felt any like roadblocks to that, and if you think there's what ways you wish that like it would be easier for people.
I can say a little bit about Tree News, and ours is like a very DIY self-published endeavor. We like to publish everything like available free online too. And I just love physical things and physical photos and print. And so I also like to do a print one. And, you know, for me, it's very much using the resources. Like when I was like through a job, I would just print a bunch of things using, you know, the photocopier that I had access to in the office. And that's still sort of how I print stuff. And, you know, now sort of I am associated with a university, so I like have some resources through that. But yeah, I think for us, it's like very small. We print a very small number of things, and it's kind of like building a community of readers that are, that we send copies to. So, you know, we print like 25 to 75 editions of things and try to hold on to things and try to archive things online. And so for me, it's always been trying to kind of make it how I can make it happen with small resources or things that I can get available or things that people contribute and building kind of relationships with people. So we're in very like small P publishing sort of DIY space, which is different than where other folks might be. So for me, yeah, like even as a young person, I love making zines, and I would just go like wherever I could photocopy. So that's kind of where my, I think, love of publishing and DIY kind of stuff came. And I think that's still very much kind of where Tree News lives.
Yeah, and our first issue was just one full page with a small insert. And now our most recent issue is like, Aaron designed it, and it's got all these beautiful photos. It's thicker, and it's, you know, it sort of, it grows, you know, but I think that you should start with whatever you have access to, because, you know, for me, it was so exciting to go to the Pittsburgh Zine Fair last year, and there was just so much energy in the room. There was every type of zine, every size of zine. You know, it's a space where anything goes. So depending on what your intention is, you know, I would just give yourself permission to forget about any sort of elitist logic of who should make and who should not make and who should read what, you know, is published by whom. You know, just throw that out, because you can find an audience by just building it. And, you know, Aaron and I have like 18 subscribers, you know, we're like not big time yet. and that's fun because we like to.
Yeah, exactly.
And people come across it and love it, and that's very fulfilling for us to see. So, you
Absolutely.
Know, just start where you're at.
I would say that the thing, like you were saying, like what are things that were in my way that are the things that can make it easier to access publishing? I would say the biggest thing that was in my way, me and Kate that run Homie House, was ourselves, and probably specifically me, because I feel like I'm someone that is very much a recovering perfectionist, and like I think me and Kate thought about Homie House way too much before we started it. Like as like, I mean, we're both pretty intense like that, but because the first stuff we put out was my stories, that's what I'm saying, it's me, because I was like, but that's like, that's too vulnerable. Like, that's too much. It's like, what? But like, yeah. So I know that I feel like just put it out there. Like, it doesn't have to be, what is perfect? That's a white supremacist idea anyways. There is no such thing as that. And the more we can like come to terms with that, the better off we're all going to be. And yeah, I think me and Gather waited for something that we felt was like perfect. And it's like, I feel like we wasted 2 years. And when, yeah. And I just feel like, and also like me and Kate are really lucky that there's two of us. Like we trusted each other. It's a sisterhood, and like, and even still it was so hard. So yeah, I would say for me, the biggest thing is trust yourself and get out of your own way and just let the art like do its thing and trust the process fully. Yeah.
I agree with that. I think earlier today I found myself telling people because I have like things I made on the table. Like, I'm just trying to be courageous, okay? Because I'm tired of being afraid of the harshest judgments I give myself. I'm like, oh, you created art, you wrote something, you made something, and you want to share it with others, you know? That's why I love zines and screen printing, because it made it accessible for us to spread it, share it, do it without having to ask permission. You know, we can all learn how to do those things, you know, collaging, you know, we could do that. And it's such a wonderful tool to have that we can make things with our hands and share them with other people, you know, and we don't have to, like you said, we don't have to get permission from other people in order to do it. And so I think both of you all in the same sort of said that, like, we had moving out of our own way, don't allow your fear, your doubt, or the external things especially to limit. But I think one thing too is just if you do struggle with like the uncertainty of it all, and being just, for me, I think I try to remember that certain things can be a practice. Like, how can I be intentional about my reading practice? How can I be intentional about my artistic practice? And that means, like, can I show up for myself to try? Because you're not gonna make the thing you wanna make right away. You have to make a lot of prototypes, or rip a couple of things up, have to make some mistakes before you're like, oh, I get into the groove of it. But yeah, you know, I feel more encouraged in this weekend and today, like the energy is, you know, been kind of like creeping up in a certain way. I'm like, oh wow, this is really quite exciting. And you know, it's very good that we are having this moment, and it's going to build. It has been building. It's a reflection of so much. Mm-hmm. But to be able to see like us come together and gather where people are not living in the box. They're like, oh, I can make a book out of seashells, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's beautiful. and that's valid, you know what I mean? That's all right too, that's great. But yeah, I think talking to people, and you know, back to just vulnerability and maybe intimacy as well, is that if you want something, learning to figure out within yourself how to say that that's what you want, and then also asking people around you for the support to help you get there. So you may not know who to ask about publishing, whether it's a more traditional path or even self-publishing, but if that's something that you desire to do, being courageous enough to say, you know what, I would like to share my work, how do I do that? And asking more and more people, there are going to be more people who offer you insights to potential, you know, experiences they have or information or resources than people who are going to say, you shouldn't write it all. You know what I mean? They're going to ask you more questions about what your needs are and what your vision is versus trying to discourage you. So I think that's the biggest part, is saying that that's what you want.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Also, the idea of showing up for your practice, I think, is really important. And one thing that I always tell my students in terms of like DIY publishing practices, that do it yourself is a very big lie. One of my friends, Darren Klein in Los Angeles, has stopped using his name only in all of his publishing projects. And it is just Darren Klein and Friends, which is the acknowledgement that no matter what you're doing, someone else is helping you do it. And I think about that a lot, especially as I'm talking to Timber students, because even if you are using the photocopier, like someone is maintaining that photocopier, or someone is running it, or if you're making things at FedEx, maybe someone is opening up the doors for you after midnight so you can use the photocopier. Like, there's always someone else involved. We have time for one more question, and we'll have to all get back to our tables. Does anyone have a question?
Can
I
give
a
comment?
We can absolutely comment.
I was sort of responding, I guess, to Paperbuck's story about the food. I watch TV the other day sometimes, old TV, and there's an episode of The Waltons where, and sort of I quickly relate to The Waltons when I was growing up, putting things for three generations of men sitting down to dinner, not a single one of them was an alcoholic. It was like, but anyway, there was an interesting episode about where this the developers coming to Walton Mountain. All the people are getting together and defending their land. They're going to defend their land. And there's a sort of absolutely no acknowledgement, I mean, like at least 100 years or less before, it wasn't the Walton, it was like some Native American indigenous people were chased or murdered, you know, off that land. And I just want to go a bit in history when they shared this old brand, it's like a narrative. No one wants to deal with it. It's not comfortable. We want this comfortable. We're living on the side of the Waltons and the whole lot also. Anyway. Will there ever be like sort of like a little footnote at the end of the program saying, you know, this story is being re-examined or leading up the part about the already, you know, indigenous people who were living there who were chased off of them before the Waltons came. But anyway, I guess
that wasn't much to do with the word. No, that's it.
Were
you saying that? Were you saying that they put that note in there, or they should? Oh, that's a great thing to offer people. Be like, listen, you still got these reruns going on forever and ever. Why don't you put a note in there?
One thing maybe just to say in relationship to that is, yeah, I think like as soon as you in North America and lots of parts of the world, but like any kind of conversation about land like leads there. And so I think like for Tree News, I think that it's just like so much that from even just like looking at some space, even like a small park or one particular tree, there's so much that it opens up in terms of the history of the United States, people's contemporary relationships to environment, and how I'm always like our most recent issue looks at herbaria and street trees, and kind of this herbaria and botany and sort of Western science is very much creating this very specific hierarchy and understanding of nature, and that reinforces you know, white supremacies, settler colonialism, et cetera. And that it doesn't take long to kind of from just looking at different things in relationship to tree news to like to get there pretty quickly. So I appreciate that the comment, and that I think that's one thing we're excited about tree news is that it's so it expands into every kind of part of life so fast. And it starts as trees, but it's not only trees or only about trees. It really leads everywhere.
Thanks for your comment. I totally agree with you, and you should write that news, that station, or whatever. Maybe share that suggestion.
Hi, well, thank you, everyone. I think that this will be a wrap. Thank you, everyone, on the panel for sharing the space with me and talking with me. Really appreciate it. And thank you, everyone, just for our preparing and creating the museum for making this happen.
Thank you.
Really yonkies.
That was so fun. Let's do this again.
I use some of these in some